gonna have to cancel ladybugs because you have to have a male bug. You know what I'm saying? You can't have ladybugs. You have to have a male bug. I'm gonna have to cancel that very well.
You just swipe away the gender. That's all.
It's
just,
yeah, that's it.
You know what I mean? No gender. Don't give it colors. Black and white, and you can kill it.
You kill it, yeah.
So anyway, now you listeners, you hear the craziness that is Michaela. Michaela, why don't you tell them, introduce yourself, tell them a little bit about yourself.
Hi, guys. I'm Michaela Dosa. I'm Haitian. Okay, I'm a represent. I'm from New York. I was born in New York. I was the only one in my family that was born in New York. I have a finger that grew back. No lie. True story. And I am an actress. I'm a creative. I'm a creative because I like to create. I was on a Broadway show in 2019 and then I'm gone, thank God. So now I'm just awaiting work, you know, with the pandemic and with everything going on. But in the midst of everything going on, I've been trying to just keep myself busy and creating content, whatever platform that is, for myself and for others to watch, whether it's funny or sad or whatever it is. And right now I've worked with Andrea. We did hits together and that was one of the best experiences of my life because that was one of my first on camera role, and it was so real, and it was so, I don't want to sound like an actor right now, but you know, it was so authentic. It was so good. I was craving it all my life, and my thirst was quenched. So thank you so much, Andrea.
What was your first acting gig, whether it was theater, film, or whatever? What was your first acting gig?
I guess you say my first professional was this show called Pips Island. It was on 42nd Street and 9th Ave. And it was interesting and a humbling experience to see the industry, to be in the industry. But then it was also an interesting experience to see how people work when money becomes the number one and they neglect their actors and the work and the craft. It was hard, but it was a humbling experience and it prepared me for, it gave me thick skin to know what's up ahead for this industry. I don't want to be, it was good. Like, oh my gosh, it was great. It was great to be able to perform for families and children and just to be in that atmosphere. I think, unfortunately, the biggest takeaway for me is, as a Black actress, you know, I have to fight harder for a lot of things. And thankfully now there are a lot of casting directors and companies that are, their eyes are open that you can't do this. You know, you can't treat people a certain way. And so things are changing. It's not perfect, but slowly but surely things are changing. But what I took away from it was I got to work extra hard.
Pippin was on Broadway, right?
Yeah, off Broadway. But I guess there were two. There was that, but then there was the humbling experience of performing and changing people's lives. Literally, like you think about it, you're like, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not changing your life. But to some degree, you really are. You know, to kids that were blind and they're deaf, they when they went into that show, they were completely different, and they were in the show, and that was very humbling. So.
Tell us a little bit about that. How did that work for kids that had health ailments, like you said, the blind or hearing impaired? Tell us about how did they do that? How did that work?
So how the show was, it was very different. It was immersive. If you've ever been to New York, I don't know if you've ever been to the show called Sleep No More. It's you get into like a building, and then throughout each and every, there are rooms, and each room is a scene, and the actors are playing out this story, but each room is a scene. So that's like what Pips Island was like. And Pips Island, when you entered the main room, you know, they had all the kids together. They had all their teacher aides, and they had each other hold. They had to hold each other's hands. Like, it was kind of like they had a rope, and they were holding onto the rope. Some of them were holding onto their other children's hands. Some of them were holding onto the teacher's hands. And as they're going through the show, usually, you know, you just watch. You're in the show. But these kids, we made it more inclusive to their ailment. If they couldn't see, we made it inclusive of what's around them. Like, we would make it more descriptive. Look at all these bubbles, and they're coming up, and they're so round and big. And look at Miss Grumbleplum. She's so big. And we're very descriptive about what it was. And then sometimes we would have them touch it. We would have them touch the characters and touch some of the props so they can feel it. And if they couldn't hear, we were more expressive. So when we did that, And when the children would come through, you would see the expression on their face and how happy they were, especially the kids that were blind, like kind of makes you want to cry because they were just so happy to feel and hear what it's like and to touch it and not feel like, oh, there's something wrong with me. I'm in this world with these characters. Like I'm in this world. And it was like, wow, that was one of the things I was really, it was a humbling experience in the show. It was really cool.
You know, and I'm a little, I guess, jealous because I don't know if Alex remembers, but I remember telling them about a script that I wrote. There was a place downtown Newark, and mm-hmm. It was a art gallery. What is it called? A Farrell art gallery. Mm-hmm. And they had a whole other space next door that they were able to lease out. And I wanted to get it, and I wanted to do a show like that. Now, granted, I didn't necessarily target blind or hearing impaired, but what I wanted to make it was like a maze. And each room that you went through, you would see a scene of the play. And then I wanted to make it, and we would have been there at least like 6 months. And so we would have been able to make it like really invest money in it to make it like very aesthetically pleasing. And
immersive.
Yeah, and give something to the eye. And I don't know, somewhere along the line when I would mention it to people, they're like, okay, you know. But I really, of course, wanted to do it for kids. But they were used to me writing drama for adults, and that's what they wanted. And I'm listening to you, and I'm saying I should have followed through.
You should have done it.
It's never too late, but you know. Yeah. I'm sure somebody probably had. Actually, there were plays like that where they would have like a house or something. And as you go through each room, you would see a different thing or not necessarily a scene, but you see a different thing. So I don't know, maybe I'll, and that won't be hard to get investors to do that, especially if it's for, you know, kids or whatever. I may read. Yep. I should not have listened. Ugh.
It's okay. Don't be upset. Like, don't be upset, Andrea. Like, this is, I don't know if you realize, this is what theater probably is going to be. People can't really sit in an audience next to each other watching something anymore. They're probably going to have to put them in groups and move around in the scene. I'm so serious.
I have to laugh to keep from crying. It's sad, but listen, I walked away from theater because, you know, film, it just pays more money. And I also, you know, I went to school for film first. I wanted to be a filmmaker. I go way back with doing film. But I found myself the other day saying, I miss theater. And I posted something too, because I was like, okay, I got to share. I can't keep this in. So how do you feel like, because I know you've done some theater, you've even done theater with me. We'll talk about that, playing Jane.
Yeah.
How do you feel now with COVID? And again, just so the audience knows, or just to remind them, what was my point? Oh my God, I'm getting old. Okay. So I'm just saying is my podcast for entertainers to come in to vent, to share their experiences and so on. So that's why I want to get into, and we don't have to get too deep. If you feel yourself getting emotional, change the subject and I'll catch
up. No.
But, you know, how has it been, not just coping with the whole COVID thing, but just dealing with the fact that it's like now like a barrier between you and theater?
I'll be honest with you. I'm not a theater lover. I'm a theater liker. So the whole, when theater, you know, with everything that happened with theater, I wasn't so upset. If anything, I was like, oh my gosh, this is a sign. Like we have to do film. Like this film is going to skyrocket, you know? So for me, I wasn't sad, but I wasn't happy because I know I have friends who are on Broadway that was making a living in New York and they weren't getting paid for a whole year. And they had to leave. They had to go back home, wherever that was. Sometimes it was out of the country. You know, they got work out of the country to work for people in New York City. And now you can't do that. So my heart really went out to those people. So when COVID, you know, and when things were coming back, but they were saying that theater and Broadway will come back when it was 2020, and they said it was coming back 2021. I was like, why? Like, why? To me, it didn't make any sense because there are, you know, you brought back a lot of other things where, you know, you have crowds of people. Why? But then it kind of made sense. But at the same time, it was like, then is it dead? So for me, it was like, it was more so I was thinking of for my friends, because I have friends who are theater lovers, who are theater goers. They will die for theater. And I was thinking of them like, this is their income. They don't, a lot of them don't feel comfortable in the on screen. They don't feel right doing film. They want to be, they feel alive in that atmosphere of a live audience, and that being taken away from them, I saw how they suffered. I saw some of them were really depressed for like 6 months, and you know, and some of them, I don't know how they were making, some of them, I don't know how they were making money. You know, and they cut everyone's paycheck, and they weren't paying them, and then they were trying to create this bill to give to the actors who were in the union. That never really passed. So there was a lot of turmoil seeing that, mm-hmm. and I was thinking to myself, I don't know if theater is dead, and what will happen when it comes back. I'm still thinking that. I feel more alive. Like I said, you quenched my thirst in the film. I feel alive when I do film. I just do.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
So let's talk about it. Before we get into Hits, which is the series on human trafficking for the listeners, let's talk about Plain Jane.
Woo!
So I love
Plain Jane.
I really did love you on Plain Jane, and I'll get into that why in a minute. But let's put some more focus on you. How did you feel? Tell the audience about who Plain Jane was, right?
Okay. Yeah. So Plain Jane, you know, like she was this 19-year-old girl who went to college. And when she went to college, she got into a lot of drugs. She got into the wrong crowd. And she wasn't responding or talking to her parents for like, probably a whole semester, no, more than a semester, probably a whole year. Yeah. They haven't heard from her.
They hadn't seen her, but they heard from her every now and again.
Yes, yes. And context, she used to be a big girl, thick girl. And when she came back for the first time after, you know, for a while, they hadn't seen her. She was very, 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 very skinny. She looked sick. She didn't look very good. There was a lot of shame and guilt, especially you felt with the character and you saw that she had for her, for the father, because I feel like her father was like her role model. And it was like, man, I let you down and I don't know how to make it. I don't know how to make it up to you. And I don't know, like that hit me. Like I was like, dang, like that really did. And I don't ever want to dishearten my parents. You know, I want them to be proud of me. And so when I was playing that, it felt so real. And having her on those drugs, I'd never been on drugs before, but for some reason I felt like I was when I was playing that girl. Maybe because people say I'm always crazy, but you know, you never know. But it's like there's a lot that goes in with that story that really breaks your heart, because it's a lot of grief and turmoil, and there's a bit of betrayal. I feel like there's some kind of mental illness. Mm-hmm. She never knew how to validate herself. She had to go to drugs and people to feel validated. And it basically almost killed her. It seems like to me. So towards the end, we see that they meet up at the airport, and then, you know, they have this confrontation at the airport, and she basically towards the end, like kind of makes up a promise to her father, to both parents, but mostly her father, like, I'm going to make it up to you. Like, I'm getting help. I'm going to start all over, and I'm going to stay here to go to school. My life is going to turn around. You did not spend all this money on me for no reason. I'm going to turn out to be not only a functioning adult, but the best daughter adult I need to be in this life.
So now thinking about her father, Keith, and his woe and his sadness and his disappointment, if you noticed, yeah. Everybody that I had play that role, I always made sure that they had the most strenuous, disappointing look that seemed very weighty, like as if someone just set a couple of houses on their shoulder, looking into Keith's eyes and thinking about, you know, how hard it hit him.
Man.
I always felt like he knows this is not the end. This is just the beginning. Because when you are on drugs and you're addicted, it's a journey, and not with your parents for two semesters, that's a year. That shows addiction, you know? And then the weight, what'd she say? She lost 150 pounds or something?
Yeah, she was a big girl.
You know what I mean? So I always felt like it was just the beginning. Did you feel like your character, and this is for all of the novice actors who are, you know, getting into acting, did you feel that your character means what she says for the moment? Or does she really realize her journey? Because I can tell you, Keith doesn't feel like the father. He doesn't feel like, he feels like it's the beginning. At least behaves. Like, oh God, now we got to go down this road first, the weight. Now, you know, her dealing with the low self-esteem and the weight. Now we got to go down this journey with this, the drug thing. And he's not young, so he knows about drugs and everything.
Yeah.
He believes what she's saying to him because she's pleading to him.
Right. I do because, like I said, I think her father, because both her parents were there, but you can tell there's a special relationship, especially the way he speaks about her before even when she enters the scene, he doesn't see her. The way he spoke about her from when she was a baby to growing up, you can tell there was a special relationship they had. And when you have that with a parent, they don't have to say much. When they give you that look, you just know, and it's like you just want to die. You want to die because it's like you don't know what to do, and you want to make them proud, but you know you screwed up. You really put yourself in a hole here. And I believed her when she was pleading and crying because she was like, I'm gonna fix this, and she was like trying to explain to him why she did it, and he wasn't having it. It was like, you know what? There's nothing I can do for you to believe me. I think I just need to do it. That's why I love that line when she was like, I'm gonna move back here. I'm gonna get help. And I'm gonna, what else? There was a line she said she was gonna, I don't remember the line. Man, she said that she's gonna get help and she's gonna move back home. And there was something else that she said she was gonna do just to prove to him, I'm gonna change for you. She said,
make it better.
Yes.
Better, you'll see.
Yes. It was that one. And she said, I'm not going to break your heart again, Daddy. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to break your heart again. And I think you could tell that ate her. Like, she just wanted to turn into a ball and just disappear because she did that.
But does she believe that she will have sobriety?
Me personally, I think she's like, all right, this is a moment thing right now. And if I just continue on in this path, I think I'll get better. I don't think she's really thinking long term, like, I'm going to get better. It's like, this is one step at a time kind of thing. Like, when you're an addict, you don't really want to admit you're an addict. So it has to be like a one day at a time. Like, all right, today I took the pills. Okay, I'm good. And then you wake up tomorrow. Okay, I need to go to therapy. So I think for her, when I was playing her, I think it was a moment. Like, I'm convinced right now I'm going to get better. I don't know about later on, but right now I'm convinced I'm going to get better.
Oh, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. I thought you were going to go all the way one way or the other. Like, nope, I think she just, or either, yep, I think she feels she's going to get better. But that's a really fair assessment because you can't see beyond, you know?
Yeah. I don't think, and because she was so much in drugs and in denial prior, mm-hmm. you know, that still plays a part of her character. So I don't think she's going to be like, hey, I'm going to be completely better. No, it's like, I'm going to take one day at a time and I'm here right now. So I'm better today. Mm-hmm. We're good. That's all that matters, right? And some people are like, no, you got to keep drinking every day. But for her, it's like, I'm better today and I'm going to keep going.
Let's talk about Kayla. And, you know, I almost didn't name your character Kayla for hits because I was like, it's too close. And Alex was like, no, it's not. I'm like, yes. I said, her name is Michaela. She said, no, it's not.
Yeah, it's Mikael.
I know. And I was like, oh, okay. And I knew it, but my brain just kept grabbing, whatever. God's working.
You call me Mikaela. It doesn't matter. Okay, she called me that. Only Angie can do that.
Yeah, you know, so let's talk about her. You did your first teaser, I think that was in 2017.
Yeah.
We're doing the teaser to kind of put out and, you know, spread around to different networks and streaming platforms while right before we were getting ready to film the pilot. You had an experience that was, so for those who don't know, I'm filming both a series and a documentary on human trafficking. But back in 2017, we began filming the teaser just to kind of draw some attention to the human trafficking series that we're working on. And I'm still pitching it. Thank God I'm in front of the right people right now. And, you know, you know, they give some tips on what they want. Do this and then come back. You do it and come back. Things change. You got to do something else. But it's okay because I'm in front of some really good people now. And I have an agent. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But it's just a matter of finding a good fit, because it's not that we weren't in front of the right people and they were interested. It's just that they don't have those kind of things, you know?
No.
And you can't water down human trafficking. You just,
and it's not Black people doing it too.
Yeah. And the only way to water down human trafficking is to not do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It can't be about it. It's literally Black or white.
Yeah.
But in any case, you played Kayla, who is in captivity of the human traffickers, and we don't get much. Get you down in the basement. So you're tied in and you're not gagged at one point. You're just tied up. You're in a dark place or whatever. What in the world is going through your mind as you sit there?
Me as Kayla or me as a part of me as Mikhail?
Of course, Kayla. Okay. And let me just let everybody know she's method. So this,
okay.
This is the reason why this is very interesting. Because, you know, method, you get a chance to really dissect, you know, what you did. Okay, so that's a good thing. Let's start there. How did you get ready to play this role of Kayla tied up in a basement, captured, knowing she's in transit to wherever the heck they're stealing her to take her to?
I know it's gonna sound weird, but I just imagine it in my mind and my body follows through and it just translates like this is real. Like I have to trick my mind. This is real in the moment. Like it's kind of crazy and it's like, oh, isn't that okay? She needs help. But no, my mind is like, this is real. Like we're not acting right now. This is real. So then the adrenaline and whatever I have, my ability to do it happens. So for me, it was like, I did a lot of research on what human trafficking was and what happens. But for me, like the space itself and the, when you tied up my hands and where we were, like it felt so real to me. It was like, at that moment, we weren't, for me at least, I wasn't acting anymore. You know, until you said cut, I was like, oh, okay, back. But for me, it was like, I'm probably going to die or about to rape me. And I can't do anything. I'm looking at the floor, by the way, where we were was, as people need to understand, we were in this basement where the floor was, yeah. It was dirty. It was nasty, girl. It was bugs. It was a spider.
Yeah. It was lots of spiders. It was dark and dismal. We went to a part of the basement where I think that they either stored things or, but I know they film a lot down there. And so, so they knew that the place was prepared for us to come in, and prepared probably meaning just going to the darkest, most unused part of the basement. listen, I had to put myself through therapy to go downstairs. If my family only knew, because there were lots of spiders. And
so, yes.
Yeah, like everywhere. And I was just like, oh my God. But so tell us, continue to tell us. So you said you prepared by, you know, saying like, okay, this is really happening to me. That's method, right?
Yeah. Like that's how I work. Like this is happening. But when I'm in the space, it could be one thing. It could be even a prop. The moment I see it or I feel it, I'm there. And so for me, it was literally just being there, just being in that basement alone was like, I'm kidnapped. And when y'all tied me up and I was against that wall on that floor with all those bugs and it was just dark. I just felt like I felt like I needed to grasp for air and I couldn't. And so for me, that's how I've always acted. That I'm just there. My brain is like, this is happening. And I've heard some people say that means you're a psycho. And I said, well, it works for me. So
I don't think it's psycho. I think it's what a lot of method actors do. They put themselves through it, you know, to bring it. And I don't even think that was a bad putting myself through it scenario. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So what I want to do is I want to show everybody. Hold on.
What's going on here? Human trafficking? This is not on your side. It's not about my side. This is bigger than a turf thing. The only thing we can do, what we need to do, is stop the whole thing from happening. That could have been my daughter. Okay? When I find this guy, I'm gonna put a bullet in his fucking head.
Scary, right?
And remembering that day, yeah.
And first of all, you were so young, and you see it all in your face. But what goes through your mind looking at that?
It's a lot of emotion. If I didn't know that wasn't me and I was watching this, I'd be like, what's going on? Like, I don't know. I just a lot of emotion that's happening right now. Like a lot of fear and a lot of pain for her.
Did you say to yourself when you were doing that role, did you say, okay, I'm kidnapped and I'm about to be trafficked? Like, did you say those words, like trafficked?
Mm-hmm. Mm-mm. I didn't say that to myself. It just happened. If that makes sense. I don't say it to myself. It's just, I'm already there. And then when the guy kept coming downstairs, and you know, he was a very sweet man in real life, but you know, when we're doing it, he had that angry face, and he was built like that. So you know, when he would, you know, he would open up the curtain, I just go into a mode. I can't explain it. It just opens up, and then it's like nothing's real until you say cut. Like until you say cut, it's all real to me. That's what I meant. Nothing's fake until you say cut. It's all real to me, and my emotions just take over. And that's what happens for me. I can't say it to myself, I'm being trafficked. Because part of my brain is like, as the character, I don't know what's going on. I just know I'm tied up and nobody can hear me. I'm going to die or he's going to rape me. So that's what me as the character is thinking. Because I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. And it makes sense. You know, I guess, you know, for me as a director, I'm definitely not an actor at all. And I do some coaching for new actors because I've been around enough acting coaches to know the beginning parts or whatever. So I don't think like that. I think what I see.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there's trafficking going on. And so that's why. And when I see that, you know, it just matches. You know what I mean? The reaction to what we know it's about. But yeah, that makes sense. That you're just in the moment thinking as the person would have been thinking.
What's going to happen to me?
Yeah. We skipped over a lot. Let's backtrack a little bit. Where'd you go to acting school?
I went to Circle in the Square Theater School. So a lot of people don't know Circle in the Square because they just know the theater. It's a theater where they play Broadway shows, but it's the only theater in the country that's also a school. So you go and watch a show, but underneath the building, there's a school. It's a 2-year program where it's basically like a vocational school. You live, breathe, and eat acting. And you're there from 8 a.m. And some days you leave at 11 p.m. So.
Did you learn method there?
No, I didn't. Like I said, I never didn't teach us method. They taught you to know how to be truthful to yourself, how to be real to the circumstances and what's real to you. And so when I went to the school, my brain was already wired like that. So for me, it was like, I got to skip certain courses and just do certain things because my brain was already like, they were like, be truthful to yourself. You can't be the best actor if you don't want to be real to yourself. And me being one of the only Black people in the course, they were like, she's so real. She just speaks her mind. Like, that's how she is. Like, you know, this is how I am. It's like, I just got to be real to myself. And as a person, if you're real to yourself, it translates in your acting. So that's just, so yeah, they didn't really teach you method. They didn't teach you Meisner. They just taught you be real to yourself, be authentic. And that truth will resonate on film or on stage.
I believe that. That's why when I direct, I always say be.
Yeah, yeah.
I tell actors, like, no, don't. Now you are performing. And everyone will know it, even the people watching it. Don't act, because that's just a step up from performing. You know, they may get a little engaged, but they remember it's not real. They'll get so caught up in that moment that they forget where they are.
Yeah.
B, you can't go wrong.
That's what my this is one of my favorite teachers in school. His name's Alan Langdon. I love him. He said, there's no right, there's no wrong, there's only truth. I said, that's true.
Mm. So when did you pick up method? I'm sorry, I'm a method head.
I know, it's like, it's hard for me because it's like, I think as a child, I think because the way I was brought up, you know, like I was brought up in a very, I was brought up in a home where my mother was very overprotective and I was the only girl. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't go outside and play with the other kids growing up because she'd been through a lot in life. So because I was home all the time, I had to be in my imaginary state all the time. Mm-hmm. So my dad was always working. So I didn't really have anyone to play with me because my brother was outside. My mom was making food and my dad was at work. So I play with myself. I would go, that sounds so wrong. I would, you know, imagine with myself, you know, and I would go, I just go places where my brain was like, I'm not limited here. Mm. I can go wherever I want here. And not realizing as I got older, that's what would give me the ability to act. It was just, that's how life was for me. This is how I could cope with life. Just going in here, no one could tell me what to do in here. No one could control me here. No one could tell me rules here. No one can say I can go outside here. I could do whatever I want in here. So I think that's when the method came out, because everything in here was so real. Because everything outside, I didn't like it. I was upset that I was controlled and I couldn't play with the boys. I couldn't do this. I couldn't play. There's so much I couldn't do because I love my mom. It's just, you know, she's just so overprotective a lot of things. And we weren't rich. So I didn't have the access to go places and go on trips and family fun daycare or whatever. Just those places that, you know, families go and do. I didn't have that opportunity. So my brain was that. My brain was the water park. My brain was the forest. My brain was, we were on Titanic someday. And the next moment we were on the top of a mountain. Next moment we you know, we were talking to Morgan Freeman and we had some tea. Now we have a good time. Okay.
So now they're getting a taste of why I call you crazy girl. So basically you had a really vivid imagination.
Yeah.
And see, a lot of times when single children, sometimes if it's just like a couple of children or the youngest child, or sometimes the oldest child, the middle child, sometimes because they feel left out, or if there's a bunch of kids, sometimes you may have more than one, they find ways to cope, especially when you have a parent that is, you know, caring and wants to make sure that you're safe and okay and, you know, keeps you from the streets. You don't quite understand it because for you, kids are out there playing, what's the problem? But they know what they're doing. And so they keep playing and you find a way to cope or whatever. Trust me, I've been there. My fingers were friends. They talked to one another. They played games, you know. Everything is a toy, a piece of straw paper on the floor.
You understand,
it can be a rag doll. I love lemons as a kid, and my mother would always put like one or two little halves of lemon in my, she'd pour lemonade and she, or Kool-Aid, and she would put the lemon in there, and I would take two out, and after I, you know, sucked all the juice out, I make them talk to one another.
Oh, I like that.
Please, I've done everything. And not that I didn't have dolls, but you got tired of them after a while, you know.
Andrea, that was the other thing about me. I did not like dolls. I hated dolls. For me, it was like, what am I gonna do with this? Like, I can't do anything with this. And I was such a tomboy. I liked trucks. I liked I liked the Hammer sets. I liked Slime and Ooze. I liked anything that was boy. I just did. And because I couldn't get that because I was a girl, my mom would get me a doll. I would just cut her hair. I was like, I'm going to cut her hair because that's the fun thing to me. Let's see her bald. Let's see her bald. And that was fun to me. Oh, well.
You know what?
My sister and I did the same thing. We were not ball people at all.
That's Alex, by the way, everybody. That's our tech person. She chimes in. She comes to life from time to time. Anywho, thank you so much, Miss Mickey, for coming on and interviewing with us. We really appreciate you taking the time out. We will see you again on the show, of course, as you are one of our co-hosts, and we're looking forward to all of your craziness and wisdom. Wizardry. I don't know. You get it.